Thankful for the good number of visitors that we have. We're going to continue our study of Daniel. We're studying the historical sections of Daniel. And this morning we're going to begin lesson two, where we're going to look at Daniel 2 as well as Daniel 4 as we go on down the line, and we'll talk about pride. I want to talk with you a little bit about what we've learned so far. We pointed out already apostasy is a terrible thing. When apostasy comes, you will find a large number of churches or a large number of people, in the case of the nation of Israel, that go with apostasy. Apostasy basically is a compromise of the very nature of faith. It really begins with a compromised home. It begins with a compromised concept of God and of sin. And it ends up where you have a time where there has to come a separation and a starting over. And we pointed out already that God chose to start over basically with a handful of people. Started over with Daniel. Started over with Daniel being taken to another country. And it just seemed absolutely hopeless. But one of the things you will see consistently through this study of Daniel is Daniel knew who God was. And he wasn't worried about numbers, peer pressure, what past people had done or not done, the critics that were out there. He knew his God. And it's quite interesting as we talk about Daniel. When you have a living faith and you're living in a pagan society, you're going to find conflict. And as we studied the last 2 weeks, the first conflict that came between Daniel and the Babylonians was in the area of what? What was the first major conflict that could have cost him his life? Was he told to bow down before an idol? What's that? Food. Did I hear you right? Did you say food? Well, now, surely food is not all that important, is it? Why would God let the first test that Daniel faced in captivity be with food? I mean, that's not one of the weightier matters of the law, is it? And matter of fact, didn't the Jews have some traditions about food? I mean, is Daniel going to let his traditionalism keep him from accomplishing God's will? Now, I'm being a little facetious with you here. The nature of a living faith is this. If God says something, even in the area of food, you stand. And I really do believe, as you want to look at the sound mind and the kind of people that you would want to rebuild, which in essence what God is doing, he wanted someone like Daniel, where there was clean and unclean foods, there were things that could not be eaten, whether they were sacrificed to idols or other various things. He was not going to do it. And Daniel was so wise. There was about his overseer, the one that was overseeing Daniel, he saw, as we studied already, this was a man of real character. And he let that be tested. And Daniel proved to be right. God took care of him and his associates. And we see a confidence beginning to build over the head of the stewards. And that confidence is going to continue. So one of the things, again, I'm sorry I wasn't here last week. I do appreciate very much for you filling in there and for that. I've got a chance to listen to the audio. Very good. Glad to have that taken care of, the lesson one covered. But one of the things that I want to let people see is that a living faith is not going to bend on anything right and wrong. And somehow, I believe, when you look back at the history of Israel, they started watering things down, and over time, they ended up where they're at. Now, lesson two is where we want to begin this morning. Lesson two. And does anyone not have an outline? Lesson two. Sean, let me go ahead and get the remaining outlines from you if I could. All right. We're now going to talk about another element of faith. I've titled my lesson, Rebuild with an Immovable Anchor. And you will see here a tremendous contrast between Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. You're going to see yet another crisis that Daniel is going to face. Let's talk a little bit about hope, the confidence in knowing who God is, and we'll kind of set up our historical study. One of the things about life is if you don't know where you're going, life has very little meaning. I heard the joke years ago about an old country boy that went up to the big city, Nashville. He was known to be a drunkard. And his friends really laughed about that. And he said, "Oh, Jake, did you get lost when you went up to Nashville?" He says, "I didn't get lost. I didn't care where I was going." And, you know, there's some people that go through life that way. They really don't care where they're going. They think about it. But we understand in life that life's not going to have much meaning unless you know where you're going. We need to come to the point in our lives to ask the questions, who am I, why am I here, where am I going? And it's quite interesting here as you talk about the very nature of God. I like how the book of Ecclesiastes put it. It says, "He has made everything beautiful in his time, and he's put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end." We as men have a very aspect within us of the desire to seek God. We are made as spiritual beings, and even the atheist out here, even the worldly person out here, every individual in this world has an innate desire to find God. Now, what happens is that Satan gives substitutes for that. You have false religions. You end up with the New Age movement. You end up with great materialism or political power. There are various things that men substitute for that need of God. One of Satan's greatest tools, I believe, in getting people to not seek God is pride. Let me ask you a question, class. What is pride? We talk about pride. What is pride? One at a time. What is pride? Seth? It's basically an inability to see yourself. It's an exaltation of oneself. Now, you know, sometimes we'll use the word pride as self-respect. I'm sure our visiting Auburn fans were proud of their team yesterday. And that's not a bad term of the word pride. It's the idea that the satisfaction with the performance. But biblically, pride is always a bad term. It's the idea of over-exaltation of oneself. It has a root element of blindness. Even the nation of Israel, God warned them over and over again in Deuteronomy 6 that, you know, God's going to bless you. He's going to give you big and beautiful houses, verse 10. And then you're going to have all of these things. And verse 12 puts it this way, "Then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage." And later on in that context, he says, "I got these things. It's my power that's given me these things." We as Christians must not give into pride. We got to remain humble. We got to keep our eyes open. And so it's important to understand that this is a real danger, that sometimes we can lose reality when we get to the point of pride. You know, it's interesting, going back to the judgment that was brought upon Israel, another point I like to make is that the reason why God brought down Israel was in order to help them. Apostasy came in order to help the people that would come back to him listen. During the time of Manasseh, notice the statement that was made. It says, "So Manasseh seduced Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations which the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. And the Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they would not listen. Therefore the Lord brought upon them the captains of the army of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh with hooks, bound him with bronze fetters, and carried him off to Babylon. And now he was in affliction, he implored the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers." Let me ask you a question, class. When Manasseh was taken away and those bronze hooks put in his lips, basically they led him like a dog. But those bronze hooks were in his lips like sores, and so if they want you to go somewhere, they pull you. There's pain. There's humility. There's a disfiguring of the face and of the lips. And he was taken to Babylon, probably walked, carrying him, pulling him with that thing. I mean, was that good or bad for Manasseh? Manasseh wouldn't listen to the Lord. Was it good or bad? It was good. Because we see the end result of this, Manasseh found out he's not undefeatable. He's not the great one who doesn't need to listen to God. He found out very quickly things in this life can be taken away like that. And he ended up trying to seek God. Now, he couldn't stem the destruction that he planted. Manasseh planted some very arrogant thoughts that the people of God took into their own destruction. But again, as we see with Manasseh being taken into captivity and in Israel being taken into captivity, we see a similar desire of God. We keep reading about Manasseh in verse 13. It says, "And he prayed to him, and he received his entreaty, heard his supplication, brought him back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God." Do you know that? Talk about us. If we know that the Lord is God, it will change us in our daily decisions. It will change us in our attitude. It will change us in our spirit. And we see what it took for Manasseh to understand that. And we're going to see the Babylonian captivity was meant to teach this lesson for Israel. And we're going to talk about in our study Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. And we're also going to look at Daniel. And we're going to learn some things about, regardless of how high you're exalted, about how God is the one that we wish to trust. Now let's start looking at the historical section, if we could. Daniel 2, 1 through 3. "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled in that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king." Now let's stop here just for a moment, talk a little bit about how Babylon is set up. Babylon had a massive clergy system. They had a massive religious system. There were those that were described as magicians, astrologers, and sorcerers, and even others, Chaldeans generally relating just to the Babylonians. They had this massive system set up where the king wanted to know what God wanted, and they'd tell him what God wanted. And they kind of had this ecumenical agreement. They all worked together. And they made everybody feel good. There was positive preaching. There was a feel-good religion. Babylon, there was nothing wrong with Babylon. They were great. Anybody they took, including Israel, they didn't. Those were weak gods. They had the strong gods. How much did Nebuchadnezzar trust these guys? You know, you don't know much about your faith or your religion. I'm going to speak broadly until it's tested. How do I know it's real? How do I know this is really of God? Those are good questions to ask. And a lot of times people don't ask those questions until tough times come. And so here the king decides to put his religion to the test. Maybe the first time in his life. And so here's the simple question he asked these people who have a direct line with God. Simple question. "I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream." Okay, let's say that question is asked to you. Any problems you got there? "I've had a dream." "And tell me about it. I forgot what the dream is. Could you tell me what my dream was?" How many of you want to take that out? What's the problem here? For you and I, if somebody asked me, "I had a dream last night, could you tell me what that dream was?" What do you say to somebody? "I don't know your dream. I don't have that ability." But now, if I go to a prophet of God, you're a prophet of God. Hey, you have a direct relationship with God. That's right. Yeah, God tells you his will. That's right. Okay, tell me my dream. You see, up to this point, he had lived in this empty tradition. Happy. Oh, those soothsayers and magicians, they don't go against Nebuchadnezzar. They understand where their paycheck comes. They preach it smooth. Everything is smooth. Now a crisis in life comes. And by the way, who gave this dream to Nebuchadnezzar? God did. And I have a feeling there was something about that dream that Nebuchadnezzar knew that was absolutely different from anything he had ever had. I believe he innately knew that God had spoken. And there's something about finding the genuine and comparing it to the counterfeit. And he's about to see that. And so now he's got this dream. And it's kind of interesting. You know, you go back to Christianity. I hope every one of you have a living faith. I hope every one of you know the value of truth and had to fight for it. I hope every one of you understand the spiritual battles that's going on in this world right now. I'm telling you, I don't believe I'm arrogant in this. I'm not trying to be condescending. But there are times I will visit in the communities that I've lived, religious services by some of the denominational groups, and it stirs me up. I've been to groups where people claim to speak for God, and they claim they could work miracles, and I'm sorry, but I saw fakes. I saw nothing verifiable. And I saw people all stirred up because of the pomp and ceremony and because of the tradition. And I couldn't help but be mindful of what a Christian, when they understand the power of a living God, the power of a living faith, versus just something that is handed down. 1 Peter 1:18, it says, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold from your aimless conduct, received by tradition from your father, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish, without spot. So what happens here with Nebuchadnezzar is that, now, you know, the magicians, what are they? What would they be good at? We know these magicians and sorcerers were fake. What are fake people good at? If you're trying to push them, if you're trying to press them, if you're trying to nail them down with something, what are they good at? What's that? Dodging, spinning, you know. You tell us a dream, and boy, we'll tell you the interpretation better. Just tell us a dream. Yeah, how would you know the interpretation's right? You know, he wouldn't know, but he wants to know this time. I want to know that which is real, and it's good for Nebuchadnezzar. He's ready to put his preacher to the fire, to the test. And I would say today, we would do well in whatever religious body we may be in, and I'm hoping we all here are standing together as New Testament Christians. But you know, whatever background you're in today, you need to be willing to test where you attend, test the stand. Now notice what happens next. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. O king, live forever. You're a great guy. You're a great guy, king. Tell the servants of the dream and we'll give his interpretation. You know, in other words, okay, we've done this before. We've interpreted dreams, okay. And the king's not going to give here. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. Let's say you're one of the Chaldeans. What you thinking here? What are you thinking, honestly? He's not going to tell the king this, but maybe you will tell the king this. What can you say about this demand? I can't do that. You know, somebody claims to be able to work miracles today. Somebody claims to speak for God. You can test them. There are ways to test them. If somebody claims to be standing with the Lord, standing in His truth, there's ways of testing them. Don't be afraid to test. You test me. You test. We need to test each other. We need to test ourselves. We want the genuine. That's what God is doing in rebuilding with Daniel, and that's what He's bringing into Nebuchadnezzar's life. Now notice, verse 6. However, if you tell the dream its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream its interpretation. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. You know, they're really smooth here. They're smiling. Just tell us the dream, buddy. We'll give you the best interpretation you've ever had. You'll feel good. It'll be great. You're going to be a great king. King answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time. He knows these guys. You know, we're kind of running the four corners here. We're trying to delay the game. We're trying to, you know, delay time here. Because you see, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there's only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Hey, you know, he knew after all, didn't he? I wonder how many people are in religious bodies today and they know it falls short. He finally knows. It took a time of crisis. I'm tired of the fake. I'm tired of the fake. Well, you have agreed to speak lying, corrupt words for me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream and I shall know that you can give me interpretation. Now, what's he saying here? If you tell me the dream, then what does he know about these people? They're from God. Folks, listen to me. Whatever religious guidance you seek in this life, you've got to know it's from God. I don't care how eloquent, how many degrees, how well a person can talk about the problems they see within the church, you've got to know it's from God. And if you don't know enough to know that, you don't know anything. I don't care what kind of smooth-talking preacher or whoever it may be that can talk to you. You've got to know it's from God. And Nebuchadnezzar's not going to let go here. Then the Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who could tell the king's matter." Uh-oh. "Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean." Well, they should have, shouldn't they? We'll start something new here. Verse 11. "It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." Now, folks, I mean, he could have asked, "Well, what you been doing? You've been telling me about God and what God has told you, and you say God knows it," but he didn't go to that point. Verse 12, he understands now they're fake. "Have you ever reached a moment in time in your life where those that you followed, maybe you followed them in a fog, maybe you went down this path because you've always done it and your parents did it, you went down this path and finally you realize it's a fake? How would you feel? You've given your money to it, you've given your time to it, you've trusted in it." Here's what the king felt, and I think he's right in it. "For this reason the king was angry and very furious, and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men. And they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them." Now, what's the problem here? What's the problem here? The king was right to be angry, but I think he became angry. You'll see with Nebuchadnezzar to go beyond reason. Where's the king making a mistake? Was he right to be angry? Was he right to kill false prophets? As a king, I think he's right. Where does he make his mistake? Yeah, he just decided to destroy them all. He listened to a few and let the few speak for all. And they weren't speaking for Daniel. Going to take care of Daniel. You know, if you make requests that only a true prophet of God could do, I'm not trying to be demeaning of those who claim spiritual gifts today. The Pentecostal movement is very powerful today. This building once was owned by a group that was Pentecostal, and they claim that God speaks to them in prophecies. They claim to work miracles. But they are rarely tested. I remember years ago a man was in a debate with someone claiming to work miracles, and he had this bottle of poison, strychnine or something like that. And he put it up on the pulpit. He said, "Now, you know, the Bible says you drink poison, it won't hurt you. You claim to have that miracle. Drink this poison." The guy wouldn't touch it. Now, at the end of the debate, the guy picked the bottle up and drank it, said, "Well, it was Kool-Aid. It wasn't real poison." You know, but he, the point was, you know, he tested. Unfortunately, years ago, back in the 40s, I heard of a preacher once who they were going to raise the dead. They had this service. They were going to raise the dead. They invited the public in, and you got to see the body in the casket. And this is back in the days where men wore hats, and they let him get close to that body, and he had a hat pin, and so he went and stuck that body with a hat pin and raised the dead. In other words, it created a riot. In that case, it was a fake thing. I'm telling you, when people make claims to be of God, test them, whether they're claiming spiritual gifts or whether they're claiming to preach the Word of God. How do we test those who claim to speak the Word of God today? 1 John 4:1 says, "Test the spirits whether they are of God." How do you test the spirits whether they are of God? Yes, you know your Bible. I love how 1 John 4:6 puts it. It talks about we are of God. He who hears us, is of God. And it says, "By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." Those that are willing to hear the apostles and test them with the prophets that we know. And so it's quite interesting as Nebuchadnezzar is about to have a life-changing situation. He's about to, once he starts seeking truth, it begins, you're going to begin to see quite a change. One of the interesting things, another example of fake people, there was some Jews who claimed to cast out demons until they met a real demon. And remember, they said, "I adjure you by the Jesus whom Paul preaches, you know, come out of him." And the people who had the demons in them beat him up, and it shocked the people that these guys were fake. And they ended up there was great fear upon in Acts 19 about because they saw the genuine. Okay, now let's go a little further if we could in our study. Daniel is now fortunately told by his overseer, "Guys, king's called you to be executed." Here is unfair. Nebuchadnezzar's right to be upset. Notice what happens next. "Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch," the head of his overseers, "the captain of the king's guard who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, 'Why is the decree from the king so urgent?'" By the way, why is it so urgent? Why is the decree so urgent? Well, how would you answer? It's a lesson for us. How did the king make his decision? Why did the Bible say it? Well, when he made this decision, what was his spirit like? He was angry, very furious. Anger doesn't oftentimes produce the righteousness of God. Every time you've been angry and you want to do something, or you did do something you felt bad about later, well, Nebuchadnezzar is one of these hot-headed, impetuous guys. He just went off the handle. Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went into his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Let me ask for a moment, did Daniel know he was going to live through this? He didn't. Christian, God will let you go through tests, and you don't know how it's going to come out. And I love Daniel because he's willing to go in the lion's den. It goes to the literal lion's den later, but he's ready to go see the king and answer. He's ready to put his God to the test. But he also, what does he ask in the meantime? What does he ask of his companions? Why did he tell his companions to pray? Great thing to share your burden with other Christians and ask for prayer. Is that what we do? Is that what we do in this life? Our companionship, we tell people so we can tell somebody else about what somebody's done? No. We tell people things so that we can receive help. Let me finish reading verse 19 here. You get to go backwards. Oh, well. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises a knowledge of those who have understood is in the darkness, and light dwells with him." Now listen here just for a moment. This will kind of summarize the point I want to make. He faces a great crisis. Where's his mind? If you just summarize these two verses, the horse of his strength. What are all of these verses have in common? God. What's your God like? Daniel's used to praising God and thinking about God and knowing what he liked. You know, everything's going to be fine. I may die and glorify God, and if I die and glorify God, I'll glorify God. But here's what my God is like. He has wisdom. He's got the world in his hands. He has time within his hands. He can't tell me to know what his dream is, and I don't know what his dream is. But God does. I'm a prophet of God. And I'm willing to go